Hey friends, Landon here. Welcome to the Waterville Community Church Sunday Podcast. We hope this message will help you to know God, grow in your faith, and go where He sends you. In a hostile, divided world, Jesus prayed that His followers, the church, would be one. Sadly, the church often reflects the hostility and partisanship we experience in culture rather than representing an alternative way. In this series, we're going to be discussing the essential convictions that originally distinguished Christianity from other belief systems and united people from different tribes, tongues, nations, and people groups into a global community that redefined the human experience. Perhaps the key to unity in our day is revisiting the foundational convictions found in what we call the Apostles' Creed and recommitting ourselves to them.
We believe in Jesus Christ,
God's only Son,
our Lord,
who was conceived by the Holy Spirit,
born of the Virgin Mary,
suffered under Pontius Pilate,
was crucified, died, and was buried.
He descended into the dead.
On the third day, He rose again.
He ascended into heaven
and is seated at the right hand of the Father.
And He will come to judge the living and the dead.
We believe in Jesus Christ.
Thanks for being with us again. We are plugging along in our series, our summer series on the Apostles' Creed. And this morning, if you didn't gather from the video, we get to talk about Jesus. I'm excited. I mean, it feels like that's what we should always be talking about in church, and in many ways, that's what we do. But we get to talk about Jesus this morning. I've mentioned this before, but we've sort of tweaked some of the language of the creed in those videos to communicate the message of unity, what sort of unifies us as believers. But at least in this instance, I want to mention what the traditional, a more traditional reading of the creed would say. It'd say, I believe in God, Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, His only Son, our Lord. The reason I bring that up is because that "and" is incredibly important. In many ways, that was the struggle, the product of years and years and years of thought and theology and toil for the early church to get to putting that phrase "and" or that word "and" in there. That the whole creed, in many ways, hinges on that. So that's part of what we are going to look at this morning. Actually, we're going to look at four words. We're going to look at believe, and, Son, Lord. Okay, so four words today. Might take a little longer than that. I'm not done. Those are the four words we're going to kind of look at. Now, to start with, I want to kind of set the stage, looking at language and communication a little bit. All right. So that'll be sort of our lens to look through. So to do that, let's talk about Zoom fatigue. All right. Has anyone experienced the feeling of Zoom fatigue? We have people in a room, so raise your hand. I don't get to be interactive lately, right? You've experienced Zoom fatigue, right? It's this phenomenon of, having virtual meetings that you just end up feeling so exhausted and burnt out afterwards, right? And it's actually been documented, and there's all sorts of kind of thoughts behind it, but at least one of them is that the nature, the way that we communicate visually is that we process the nonverbal first and then the verbal. It happens so fast that we can't typically tell. But what we do is we pay attention to dozens of different nonverbal cues, inflection, tones, things like that, and that really sets the stage for us to assign meaning to the words that are being spoken to us. And so, you know, that has been kind of developed over time, but then all of a sudden we get thrown into these meetings where your brain is sort of still doing that, but you don't quite get all the visual cues that you're used to, right? Typically, people are smaller on the screen than they are in person. I suppose it depends on the screen, but that's been my experience so far. You can't quite pick up everything that's going on with them, and so, right, you're kind of constantly on hyperspeed, right, trying to take it all in. On top of that, a lot of our virtual meetings are like Brady Bunch style. You have 6-7 people sort of stacked up. You either have the speaker view where whoever's talking just gets thrown right in your face, which is a little off-putting, or you have the gallery view that's the Brady Bunch style. So you don't know who's talking and when. You're trying to like rapidly move around and figure out who you need to pay attention to. And we don't naturally We're not naturally able to filter out information. I've been advocating for years, but I've never had a meeting where I've talked to seven people stacked up like a cheerleader pyramid, right? But yet, that's kind of what it looks like in a virtual meeting. Normally, we sit around the table, and whoever is talking, that's who you look at, and it sort of filters out, you know what not to pay attention to. So like kids paying attention at home, like that's why it's important to look at people when you're talking, because it helps filter out information. All right, so all of our communication is contextual. Right, so there's the micro context, right? That's what I'm talking about this morning, like the nonverbal cues, the tone, and like all that sort of stuff that gives meaning to it. But there's also larger context that it's found in, right? The culture, the history, the time, the place, all of that sort of informs how we communicate. And we were designed to communicate the clearest in person, okay? We're designed to communicate the clearest person to person. Right. Again, because there's people in the room, I'm going to ask a question. How many of you have had a text message conversation that just has gone terribly wrong? There's been some miscommunication somewhere down the line, right? Yep, we got, okay, thank you. Happens to me, actually a decent amount. So what do you do? What do you do in that situation when you're texting somebody and it's clear that you're kind of being misunderstood, right? Well, you ignore them and you pretend you didn't get their messages, right? Is that what you do? No, you move up a level of communication, right? So if it's text or email or whatever, and there's all sorts of miscommunication happening, well, I might follow that up with a phone call. And if that doesn't work, I might eventually get to like, we just need to sit down in a room and like hash this out person to person, right? We communicate the clearest in person. And so that's moving up communication levels. All right, half of you fell asleep during that. So that's an important, why are we talking about this? Well, what if, so just be sort of a fun lens to look through, what if that's what it was like with God? That was partially what God's experience was. Think about the Old Testament, and we're going to just strictly look through the lens of like communication. You have these moments kind of scattered throughout where God speaks to somebody. That person, in turn, goes and speaks to the rest of the people. Those people then, in turn, pass that down generation to generation. We get all sorts of miscommunication problems. And then, you know, maybe another prophet, and then the cycle starts again. And then maybe there's another prophet, and God does it again. But, you know, in some ways, it looks like a giant game of telephone. You know the game I'm talking about, right? You might whisper to one person, you go around the circle, and then you laugh at how hilariously wrong it became at the end. Right? It's funny in a game. Like I might start out with pictures of the Serengeti, and then it makes its way around the circle, and then it ends up with pictures of spaghetti, which would actually be fairly successful for that game. Right? But right, it would be right. It's kind of funny and fun when it's a game. But like, what if you're actually trying to communicate something? Right? Photographs of a beautiful place very different than like buckets of pasta. Right? So. What if that is sort of what is going on in the Old Testament? What if that's sort of what happens with Jesus? That Jesus is God sort of moving up a level of communication. C.S. Lewis once said that the only way for the characters in a story to truly know the author would be for the author to write themselves into the story. Right, that the only way for the creation to know the creator would be for the creator to write themselves into the story. And in many ways, that's what the creed is about. That's what our confessions of who Jesus is about. That Jesus reveals God to us. All right, so that's communication. All right, now there's also the pesky little business of language. Right, language is always evolving, constantly evolving, both formally, like new words are added to the dictionary all the time, but also informally, formally. Right, I use the phrase Zoom fatigue, and my guess is that the majority of you knew what I was talking about. 6 months ago, that might not have been the case. Right, and so, so things kind of evolve and change over time. Words can take on different meanings over time, and sometimes words have multiple meanings all at the same time. And that doesn't even account for like sarcasm and things like that that can change it. Right, so words are constantly evolving. And so it's important, I think, to ask. So the first word we're going to look at, right, is believe. And what we should ask is, you know, what do we mean when we say we believe in Jesus Christ? Like, what do we mean by that word? We keep using that word. I don't think it means what we think it means. Sorry, Princess Bride quote, if anybody caught it. Thank you. What do we mean by the word believe? I think at least some of us probably think of it as like it's something factual that I should just check off on, right? That we believe Jesus existed. Right? But if I'm telling you a story, so like my son who's 7, Finley, he just started learning to swim in the deep end, right? Without a life jacket, without floaties. So it's a big deal. We're really proud of him. He's working on it. It's been really fun. But he was very scared. He was very nervous to try it at start. So, you know, I'm in the pool with him. He's in the deep end. He's holding onto the wall, doesn't have the floaties. And I say, "You can do it, buddy. I believe in you." Right, what am I saying? Right, you guys all caught that, right? I'm saying that I believe he is able to do what's being asked of him, right? I have faith that he can do what he's trying to do, right? And I'm using it as an encouraging sort of statement. You know that it would be absolutely ridiculous to think that I'm saying, "You can do it, buddy. I affirm the empirical evidence of your existence," right? And yet, a lot of times that's what I think comes to mind for us when we think about the creed. But it would have been just as ridiculous to the early church leaders, because these are people that like lived and breathed and walked with Jesus. So it's like, yeah, we believe in Jesus' existence. Like, oh, I know Jesus existed. When I say we believe in Jesus, we mean something more. We mean that we believe in who he is, that he is who he said he is, that he's going to do what he said he's going to do. We are putting a faith and a trust into him, that's what we're talking about. And that leads us to the word "and." Okay, so that's number 2 of 4 if you're keeping track at home. So, it leads us to the word "and." The early church leaders, the early apostles, they had real lived experience with Jesus. And so they put their faith and trust in him because of who he is. And so that leads them to saying, okay, we believe in God, but like we also believe in Jesus. And that wasn't, just kind of like out of the blue theology. Like Jesus talked about that himself. So you see in John 14, one of Jesus's disciples, Philip, says this. He said, "Lord, show us the Father and we will be satisfied." Jesus replies, "Have I been with you all this time, Philip, and yet you still don't know who I am? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. So why are you asking me to show him to you? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I speak are not my own, but my Father who lives in me does his work through me. Just believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Or at least believe because the work you have seen me do." Right? Jesus does it, and we'll look at a couple different passages. Jesus does this multiple times. He appeals to people off of their experience with him. Their experience informs their belief. Right? So we get this situation. They believe in Jesus. So it's God and Jesus. That creates all sorts of problems for the early church, because they were fiercely monotheistic. Like there was one God and that was it. That was the story that they knew and was told and passed down. That was the God that they understood. That's the context of which this is coming into. And it seems like Jesus understands that, but he keeps pointing it back to, but just look at me. Base your experience on me. Right? And one of the critiques that can be found in the Apostles' Creed that doesn't mention anything about like the story of Israel. Like a lot of the Old Testament is not included into the creed. And part of the reason is because that was sort of the waters they were swimming in. And so like that was already assumed knowledge. The The creed was giving them the tools to reimagine that story, to re-examine it. And that's what the gospel writers do. The gospels are the four stories we have, the four books we have in the Bible that tell the story of Jesus. Each one of them anchor their story of Jesus in the story of Israel, in the Old Testament in some way. Mark starts off, his gospel starts off with a bang, but basically starts off with John the Baptist that he connects back to the prophet Isaiah. Luke connects his to prophecies before Jesus' birth and connects that to prophets in the Old Testament. Matthew, if you've read it, starts off with a genealogy, which is incredibly boring to us, but would have been really important to them because it's tracing the, you know, God's faithfulness through a lineage of people leading to who Jesus was. They're all anchoring into the Israel narrative, into this ever-unfolding story of God in the Old Testament. But then we get to the gospel writer John. And John's gospel was likely written a bit later, and so he had the benefit of some, you know, further theological thought. And so he actually connects, he starts off his story, he connects Jesus to the very beginning, even before creation. We know this because he starts off saying, in the beginning, which is a really great opening line. A lot better than 14 generations of people, at least for us. But one of the things that's great about it is that it fits within the narrative because the Old Testament, Genesis, it starts off with the same thing. And so it's a callback to that story. So it's a reimagining of it. And so in Genesis 1:1-3, we see this. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and empty, and darkness covered the deep waters. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of waters. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. So John has this problem. Like, okay, we believe in God, one God, Yahweh, that's our story. But our experience with Jesus causes us to believe in him. What do we do? And John rereads his story and looks back and says, Jesus has been there all along. He's been there in the very beginning, right? Contemporary Jewish thought to the time the Gospels were written was that they put, and in many ways, they personified God's word, right? So we see three characters in the creation narrative. We see that there's God the Creator. We see the Spirit of God, but then God speaks and creation happens. It's the speaking. It's the words that God gives that creates life. And so they, you know, started to personify it a little bit. And John looks back and says, no, that was Jesus. Right? And so he says, in the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He existed in the beginning with God. God created everything through him, and nothing was created except through him. John obviously goes on to connect the word to Jesus. Famously in verse 14, he said, you know, God, or the word put on flesh. I think the Message translations is God put skin on and moved into the neighborhood. Right? He's connecting the word to a person. He's connecting that person to Jesus, and he's bringing that all together. He's saying Jesus pre-existed creation. He's not a product of creation. He didn't come later in the story. He was there at the very beginning. So what Jesus says, God says. What Jesus does, God does. What Jesus is like, God is like. And so that's part of the early church kind of working these ideas together. Like, because of our experience with Jesus, we have to sort of rethink and reinterpret our understanding of God. But then they see that, right, he was there. Which then leads us to the third word, son. Now, this was unexpected in a lot of ways to them, but this was the language that Jesus himself used. He would call himself son, the set apart, the unique son of God. And it was not controversial in any way to say that God was a father, or to call God father. That was common language. But to say that you were God's only son was, you would be accused of blasphemy. And in fact, Jesus was. And a response to one of the accusations, he says in John 10, verses 36 to 37, he says, "Why do you call it blasphemy when I say I am the Son of God? After all, the Father set me apart and sent me into the world. Don't believe me unless I carry out my Father's work. Right? So Jesus understands the context of like why this is hard for people to believe. His appeal over and over again is like, but look at me and look at my life, right? Use your experience of me to inform your understanding of God. Right? And so he's bringing that challenge together. And the way that he communicates it is that God is a father and he is God's son. And we've talked about this a bunch of times recently, so I won't go too much into it, but the implications for that is that's basically the foundation of how we can say that God is love. Right? If God, to be a father is to have a son, to be a son is to have a father, that God in God's essence is relationship. And love, by definition, is relational. And so we see the foundation of the world, the foundation of creation, the foundation of us is built on a community of perfect self-giving love. Right? That love is the force behind life and light in our world. And that brings us to the fourth word this morning, and that's Lord. Now, some of you may have found what I said interesting. Some of you may have found what I said kind of basic. Some of you are like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't care. But I think everybody has the can relate to this experience, right? So what? Some degree, so what? Like, why dive into this? Why try to connect the theology? Why give the backstory? Like, so what? What does it matter to us? You see, for the early church, it was so important that they got the answer to the question, who is Jesus, right? Because the implications were, Jesus is Lord. And in their time, that was a really big deal. There's a lot of cost that came to that. See, they lived under the Roman Empire, under Roman rule, and the common thought was that Caesar was Lord. Caesar was the one that brought peace and prosperity to the world. Caesar was the one that decided who would live and who didn't in many ways. Caesar was the ultimate force and reality in the world. And so Roman soldiers or even Caesar himself would come to towns and they would say, "Hail Caesar," and everyone would have to say, "Caesar is Lord." Except for these people following Jesus that would say, "Jesus was Lord." Now, it wasn't a private, it wasn't just a private declaration. They spoke it out loud, and the implication was, we say Jesus is Lord, and that means Caesar is not. And that led many of them to all kinds of persecution, including imprisonment and death. See, there was a cost to saying Jesus is Lord, and so they had to be sure that it was worth it. Right? They had to be sure that it was worth it. For those of you that are married or, you know, want to be married, which it's not everybody needs to or should be, but right, there's an appropriate season before marriage where the question you're trying to answer is this the right person? Is this the person I want to marry, the person I should marry, the person I'm going to commit to, right? There's an appropriate time for that. After you've been married for 30 years, it's not the best time to continually ask, is this the person that I'm supposed to marry? It means that something has gone wrong. I saw that. It means that something has gone wrong, right? You've missed out on the meaning and the purpose of it, and that that lack of understanding would have shaped the marriage relationship itself, right? So to be married, to get married, presupposes that this person is worthy of me sacrificing and giving up a part of my life for, right? To say that Jesus is Lord presupposes that Jesus is worth it. You want to be sure because of the sacrifice involved, right? To be married is to say that, like, I am no longer in charge. I mean, especially if you're a husband. It's just not the case anymore, right? There's, no matter what, it's not about what I want and what I feel and what I think. Although those things are important, I'm not the only one anymore. I have somebody else that I need to think of and take into consideration in everything that I do. And it's really no different with Jesus. But the hard part for us is, what is the parallel, right? Because Jesus is Lord. They adopted that language very specifically from the Roman Empire, from their culture. It doesn't translate the same way to us today. And so I've been trying to figure out, like, what is the parallel for us? I mean, do we say, right, Jesus is president? I don't think so. It doesn't have the same, right, kind of meaning. Right, we don't live in a culture, I guess, regardless of your beliefs, where the right president kind of has ultimate authority to dictate everything in our life. Right? Is Jesus the CEO? Is Jesus your boss? I think all of those fall short. So the question is, what do we view in our culture? What do we view as the sort of ultimate determiner of our lives? Like, who ultimately is in charge of our lives? I think it's us. I think the best parallel for us today is we say Jesus is Lord, and that means I am not. I mean, think about it. Like, we grew up in a country where the American dream is that you can do anything you want to if you work hard enough, that it's the land of opportunity. If you grew up in the 80s and 90s, like, you could be whatever you want if you put your mind to it. And that was told that many times. That was a lie. But that's the message that we get over and over again. Right? And so we look at our lives and we think, I determine my destiny. I'm the one that makes the most of opportunities. I'm the one that ultimately decides what is going to become of my life, right? And we're told that, like, I am the customer and the customer is always right, and beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and I guess I'm the one that's the beholder, right? And I can do whatever I want or desire or should. I determine what is right or wrong, good or bad, true or false. Right? I'm the one that determines what's valuable and what isn't. I'm the one that gets to decide what I choose to do and not to, because I have freedoms and rights and privileges and choice. And you can't take that away from me, and no one can take that away from me. And if you say that to me, I'm going to say you do you and I do me, because that's what our culture respects. Because what we ultimately look at is that we are our own authorities. We are the lords of our life. Unless Jesus is Lord. I think the implication for us this morning, I think the so what for us this morning, is to say that Jesus is Lord is to say that I am not. That I am a servant of the law of love. That at some point I will need to sacrifice something of my own freedom or my own privilege or my own choice or my own wants or my own desires for love of God and love of others. And saying Jesus is Lord and I am not might mean that I end up going places or doing something that I didn't want to do or I wouldn't choose to do in the first place. Doesn't happen so much in our culture, but it could lead to persecution, imprisonment, or death. Historically, it has at some points for people. So, how's that for a sale this morning of saying Jesus is Lord? All right? But think about it. We make these kind of sacrifices in relationship all the time. Right? If I wanted to sort of maximize personal freedom and choice in my life, like, I would have never had kids. I love my kids, but they take up time and money and energy, and they eat all my food, and I don't get a chance to, like, nap when I want to nap or ever nap or, really sleep all that much. And I don't know if I've got relatively young kids. I don't know if anyone else has had the experience of, like, having to sneak snacks in your own house from your kids. Right? I'm not, like, free anymore. My own house that I bought with the candy bar that I bought, and I have to hide from my children, right, to try to sneak because they have crazy selective hearing. I could be 2 inches from their face saying, clean up your toys, right over their head. I could be a block and a half away, open up a Kit Kat bar, and they teleport right there. What's that? What's that? Can I have some? Can I have some? What can I? I'm hungry. I want some. You never give me any candy. Right? That's just life with kids, and it's a sacrifice, and you give stuff up for it. but I love my kids. I wouldn't trade it. I give up something of myself to love them. That's the law of love, sort of an action in our life. What Jesus does is asks us to extend that. He asks us to extend that to everybody. Right? So I have a long day. I'm on the couch. I'm watching a brainless, mindless show. And my kid comes up and they need a Band-Aid that they don't really need, but they've asked for it 20 times. Right? I don't correct them for infringing upon my rights in that moment, right? I don't lecture them about how much how hard I worked and how I bought this house and this TV and how I deserve a break, right? I don't discredit them. I get up off the couch and I help them. Even if I don't think they really need the Band-Aid. Even if I, especially when I don't want to get up off the couch, which I hardly ever get off the couch by choice, right? The law of love ultimately dictates us. It's not to say that like my wants, my feelings, my rights, my decisions, my choices, that's not important. That is important. And we live in a great country that we have those privileges given to us. But those are not ultimate. It's not the ultimate determiner decide of our life, that Jesus is. And that's what we're saying when we say Jesus is Lord. That's what we are committing to. That's the story that we are participating in. And so it's important. It's important to figure out who is Jesus. Right? The early church did the legwork for us, but we still need to come to that sort of decision on our own, so that we can get to the place and say, Jesus is Lord. Right? That's not an ending point. That's a starting point. Right? Jesus is Lord is not the end. It's the start of a new journey. Similarly, like getting married is not the end. It's the beginning. Right? Having kids is not the end. It's the beginning. Jesus is Lord is the beginning. And it's going to radically change our lives and dictate our lives, largely from the law of love. So that's what we profess. That's what we confess when we gather and we say these parts, these clauses of the creed. And to say that Jesus is Lord is to say that I am not. But the great thing about it is that I get to participate in something that's far greater than I could ever do myself on my own. And I get swept up into something bigger. So that's, I guess, the encouragement for us this morning. That's the challenge to think about. You might be in a place that you're trying to decide, is Jesus worth following? And that's really important. And I would encourage you to continue to explore and navigate that. And read and come to church and talk to us if you want to talk to us. But some of you might be in the place of who is Jesus? And you need to answer that question. But I think many of us, the important question is like, how do I follow Jesus here and now? And that's what the church is about. It's about us wrestling with that and working through that together in the messy, uncertain life that we live in right now, to continue to be challenged and pushed and sometimes corrected and ultimately nudged and moved towards the law of love, towards living in a world where Jesus is Lord. That's what we try to do individually. That's what we encourage of each other. So in a moment here, we're going to participate in communion.
If you had questions during the message, text them to 567-246-0807, and we will address them during our next Facebook Live Q&A. For additional content, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our website, watervillecc.org. You can also watch our live stream service on YouTube every Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern, or replay it anytime. Thanks for listening.